Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Finally, welcome back, everyone, to another long-awaited episode of the 8-Bit Adventures podcast. This is episode 263. I am your mostly not sick anymore host, Sean Hayes. How is everyone doing? oh boy, folks. Let me tell you, having a kiddo in daycare during cold and flu season, it is rough. It is really brutal. And apparently this was like a bad year. Apparently the CDC had predicted that this year was going to be a bad year for colds and flus on top of COVID. So, yeah. Oh, I ended up, I needed to take some time off, of doing everything. I got some sort of non-COVID upper respiratory infection that absolutely wiped me out, you know, couldn't really talk, you know, would sound awful. And then you just a lot of coughing and everything, just tired all the time. So yeah, oh, it's been brutal. Pretty much almost fully recovered, just dealing still with some bronchitis. Not dealing with the coughing anymore so much, but just, definitely, still working through being able to talk for long periods. So, if I may need to take breaks to like catch my breath, that's why. Yeah, I mean, you know, as far as I can tell, the infection's all cleared up and everything. It's just kind of fully recovering from that. So, which might take another week or two, but yeah. Oh boy, there was a lot of stuff happened while we were taking off. Not in the news, sure enough. Turns out there was more stuff about those Nintendo contractors, and that's kind of still an ongoing thing. I don't have it in the quick fire news this week, just because I wanted to just focus on what was happening this week. If there's more stuff that comes out about that, I've definitely include it in the notes. Long story short, newsflash. If you're a contractor who works for Nintendo of America, chances are it's not great. Just like it's not great to be a contractor pretty much anywhere else in the gaming industry. So, again, unionization, folks, might help. And what do you know? That's actually one of the stories that we have this week. So, deep dive today is going to be a topic near and dear to my heart, D&D 4th edition. I got... It's like every day there's a whole new tweet thread where either somebody has some brilliant idea for how to quote unquote fix 5th edition, or hey, wouldn't it be great if 5th edition had this thing, you know, that I thought up of all by myself, and or complaints about D&D and some of the systems in 5th edition that can all be solved with stuff from 4th edition that weren't carried over, wizards. So we're going to talk about that. I love 4th edition, so buckle up. So I'm very excited to be back. I may need to, again, take breaks to kind of just catch my breath a little bit. And hopefully we're going to try and keep this to an hour, keep this episode to an hour, so that way I don't get too tired out. You might say, Sean, Doctor Strange is out. Why aren't we doing a Doctor Strange spoiler cast? That's going to be next week. My wife and I are going tomorrow night. Or if you're listening to the audio version, we're going tonight to go see it. So very excited for that. So that'll be next week's. Next week will be a Doctor Strange spoiler cast. Looking very forward to that movie. I'm so hyped for it. So, all right, now that we've gotten that out of the way, why don't we get into this week's quick fire news. All righty. Hang on, I gotta get my slides ready. First up, BioWare. Hey, speaking of unionization, QA testers and localization staff contacted through Keywords Studios to provide support to BioWare have been trying to unionize. Part of the reasoning for that was BioWare, full-time employees at BioWare have a hybrid model regarding work from home. The contracted workers were not given that option and were told to return to the office. And their push toward unionization basically allowed them the ability to negotiate being able to continue working from home. It's almost as if it works, folks. So just another, you know, move. It's entirely possible that we may see more of this happen, especially among contracted workers, if they start forming unions. And whether this carries over into other industries, it'll be really interesting to see. But again, yeah, they were able to, you know, and I, as far as I understand from the article that was on The Verge, that's just like because of the fact that they're pushing to unionize, like they were given this. But that's not like now they're going to stop trying to unionize. No, they're still going forward. It's just like that was one of the reasons for doing so. So, yeah, good on them. NVIDIA, GPU manufacturer, has to pay a $5.5 million settlement over charges that it unlawfully obscured the number of graphics cards sold to cryptocurrency miners. And it turns out NVIDIA basically tried to play it up as like, so the reason why they're getting in trouble is they build it as, graphics cards in their gaming division sold really well. And they were trying to say this is like the gaming division, you know, specifically like we sold it to gamers and had a great year doing that and everything. When it turns out they likely went to cryptocurrency miners and, investors basically are now realizing cryptocurrency is a really volatile market and maybe they don't actually want to invest in it. Or in products that are going toward that, as opposed to products that are going toward somebody that's just going to buy it to play games, which is, you know, a much more stable market. Like people buy it and then they're going to use it and they're going to use it for like recreation and they're not going to use it for basically crypto farms. So essentially, yeah, investors got mad, essentially that NVIDIA kind of lied to them. Yeah, it was a settlement. So they paid $5.5 million to settle it. So shame, shame, NVIDIA. Next up, here's some fun news. Oh, this is great. EVE Online, the longtime sci-fi MMO, will now have official integration with Microsoft Excel. This is great, folks. I saw this headline and I went, I gotta talk about it because the joke has long been that EVE Online is basically playing a spreadsheet simulator in space. And granted, there are ways to play the game where like you don't have to touch any of that at all. But a big portion of like the manufacturing aspect in the game involves basically like managing spreadsheets and timetables and things like that. And so the fact that it now has direct via like scripting essentially with Excel, like it basically like imports data from an Excel file is how that works. It seems like there were also some like other, you know, quality of life improvements. There's apparently some sort of story arc that's being introduced to the game, like an actual like narrative story arc. Really, the big news for everybody is that it's going to directly integrate with your spreadsheets now. So kudos to Eve. Finally caving in and giving the people what they want. All right, next up, we've got some Blizzard news, and actually not terrible news for once. So we got two pieces of news here. Only going to use one slide to save slide space. First up, they have revealed their newest mobile game, Warcraft Arclight Rumble. It's going to be a free-to-play sort of tower defense with commanders-like game. Might be a little bit of Clash of Clans-ish. You know, details are still a bit light. It's not out yet. It's coming to Google Play first and then coming to iOS later. So it will not be available on Apple devices for a while. But yeah, you know, and it's made to look like little sort of toy soldiers, like little clay figures. So the five commanders are, we have basically a Thrall-esque orc. We have a night elf. We have an alliance soldier. We have a gnome. That's only four. Did they only show four? I mean, in the graphic, they also have what looks like a Wildhammer dwarf. But I'm not sure if there's another commander that they just like left out. Yeah, because that kind of covers. Well, it's a little weird in that like most of the factions are alliance. It feels like there should have been like another horde faction in there, like Tauren maybe or something. But who knows? So this will be coming soon. This was the big mobile game announcement that everybody thought was, oh, well, World of Warcraft's coming to mobile. Not quite. It's just a Warcraft IP game that's coming to mobile. So, the other piece of news, Jessica Martinez, formerly of Disney, has been hired as the developer's first head of culture vice president. So Martinez, will basically kind of be in charge of fixing the company's cultural problems, and ensuring, trying to build a strategy for how to promote a better workplace culture. Good on them. Hopefully it works out. We'll see. We'll keep track on progress for that. And, you know, maybe if things continue, maybe if, you know, things get better and prove that it gets better, that maybe Blizzard can try and salvage some semblance of reputation again. So, next up, hey, you remember Avatar, which came out in, 2009, I think? Its sequel is finally coming out. The Way of Water. So, it's been widely reported for a while that it was going to be basically Avatar, but then focused on the oceans of Pandora. I was surprised to see. So there was a trailer released. I was surprised to see a lot of human industrial stuff going on. I guess it's just humans didn't learn their lesson and they're coming back to Pandora to farm resources. Who knows? So we'll see what happens. Also a little weird, it makes sense for Jake and some of the other characters from the previous movie, like they're still there. But just like the fact that they fully poached like all of the sort of tech and equipment from the base, it seems. Because there seems to be a lot of Na'vi that are equipped with like assault rifles and things in this film. Feels a little weird compared to how they were presented in the first film. I don't know. So we'll see. It's coming, folks. It's actually happening. So yeah, I thought it was worthy enough just to talk about it, you know, since the trailer's out and it's like the first glimpse that we actually got of the film. So yeah. Next up, Monster Hunter Rise Sunbreak. The expansion Monster Hunter Rise will release on June 30th. There was a sort of Monster Hunter presentation, like their own little direct sort of thing, where they talked a little bit more about the game and some of the systems and everything. It will include Master Rank. We've known that. New monsters and more monsters. I hesitate to say new because some of them are just like some of them are actually new, like the flagship monster that's pictured here. Whereas like other ones are quote unquote new, as in they're not in Rise, but like they've appeared before, or new variants of monsters in Rise, including things like Seregios. There's going to be an ice variant of Somnacanth, as well as a lava variant of Almadron, because Almadron already was a nightmare-inducing fuel. One of the systems they're going to have are follower NPCs. So this is going to be NPCs from the various locations. You can then recruit to join you on hunts. So that's neat. That's cool. Like, I don't know if Monster Hunter has done that before. It certainly doesn't feel like it's done it since Try. But basically, this is allow you to do the multiplayer aspect. But if you don't have anybody to play with, you can bring followers along. And I guess there will also be like exclusive rewards for doing so. So that's neat. I like that. Here we go. Here's tongue twister. New mechanic. Switch skill swap. So we've got our switch skills that were introduced in Rise, which, you know, doing things where the different moves that you can do with your weapons, and you can build like loadouts of them and everything. Essentially, you will be able to build a second loadout and switch between the two during hunts. You will no longer have to, like, you know, just be stuck with one set of skills. And that you can switch them on the fly as a way to mix up your strategy against a monster. And then in addition to that, there's swap evade, which is while you're doing that, you will be able to dodge during it. So that way you can then also do all sorts of wild evasion combos. So I fully expect when this drops, there's going to be a lot of very technical Monster Hunter players who are going to have a lot of fun seeing how they can really push the system to its limit. So I'm excited about this. And then a whole bunch of quality of life improvements. Relatively minor stuff, you know, things like if you run at a wall, you won't have to like use your wire bug to jump into the wall to start running up it. You can just start running up the wall if you run into it. Yeah, very, you know, minor little things like that. So yeah, very excited. Pre-orders are available now. This is essentially going to be a digital expansion add-on to Monster Hunter Rise. So it seems like regardless of what version you picked for Monster Hunter Rise, whether physical or digital, this will be like a digital expansion. If I'm wrong, please let me know. There will be like special editions available, which give you a couple of extra little bonus things. There's also like going to be a bundle package where if you haven't played Monster Hunter Rise yet, it will include Rise and Sunbreak. So I don't know if Monster Hunter does that now with World and Iceborne. Like, if there's a bundle where you can buy them both at the same time, it's kind of that. So, yeah, June 30th, right around the time for my birthday. It'll be great. Looking forward to it. Love Monster Hunter. So, there we go. All right, today, we got an Indie World Showcase. Now, normally I try and save the Indie World Showcase for the deep dive because there's just so much going on. This was a little bit of a smaller showcase, And I'm just going to run through the stuff that's announced. I'm not going to go into as much detail. I really wanted to talk about the fourth edition stuff, basically. But upcoming titles for Switch, upcoming indie titles for Nintendo Switch that were announced, from some of them released today to 2023. They include Ooblets, Batora Lost Haven, Elekhead, Soundfall, Wild Frost, totally accurate battle simulator, Gunbrella, We Are OFK, Silt, Mini Motorways, Wayward Strand, Cult of the Lamb, and Another Crab's Treasure. Just to run through some of these really quick. Elekhead is a puzzle platformer where you are playing like a little like plug light bulb guy, and you're charged with electricity. The surfaces you touch then become electrified, and the puzzle is like to figure out how to power walls and platforms and stuff so that you can progress through this factory. Soundfall is a dungeon crawler that looks like it's sort of the next evolution of Crypt of the Necrodancer, where it's real time, so it's not. Like, Crypt of the Necrodancer is, like, it has, like, sort of orthogonal movement that you then move around based on the beat, sort of a thing. This is, you know, free movement and real time, but, like, timing your attacks and stuff to the soundtrack. Wild Frost is published by Chucklefish. It looks like a cute little... It's a card-building roguelike, or deck-building roguelike, so sort of like Slay the Spire, but you are fighting against the forces of winter to stave off winter. Gunbrella is like a side-scrolling sort of action platformer where it's you have an umbrella. It's basically you have like the Penguin's Umbrella, where it like, you know, shoots bullets, but also, you know, can help you like float through the air and things like that. We Are OFK is like a it's basically a visual novel about the pop group OFK and a story from them set in L.A. Silt is taking a page out of Super Mario Odyssey. It is an underwater sort of scuba diving game in which you possess creatures to progress through the world and fight off giant leviathans. Mini Motorways is essentially an urban planning game in which you are tasked with designing roadways through various cities. And then Another Crab's Treasure is it sort of has that I don't know if it's Unity sort of look to it. It just like that little bit of plasticky cell shaded style. It is a Souls like action game in which you play a crab. You play as like a little crab dude. You take lots of damage. Unless you find like a shell to hide under, which is sort of your block function. So there you go. Those are the indies. So those are the primary indies that they showed. There was like also that reel at the end, but there were too many and it was going too fast for me to note stuff down. Again, I apologize. Also, it happened today. So like, it's difficult to note this stuff when they do it on a Wednesday. But yeah. So that is going to wrap up our quick fire news. So folks, you better buckle up because it's time for our deep dive. So let's talk about D&D 4th edition and its undeserved bad rap. All right. So as I said, there's not really a day that goes by when I don't see some sort of social media thread where it's either newer players who came in to D&D with 5th edition, or people who kind of play D&D, but like, it's not really their thing. And like, they're looking on ways to improve games and things like that. Or people who, played 3rd edition, skipped 4th edition and went straight to 5th. People who, you know, played Pathfinder and went to 5th edition, or whatever. Basically, people who never played 4th edition for whatever reason. Look at 5th edition and see, like, I like 5th edition. There are design issues. Okay? Talked about them quite a bit. Everybody knows. If you are not, so I will say, not everybody knows. If you are not familiar with my views on challenge rating, it is garbage. It is a garbage way to design encounters, and you shouldn't do it. And it was a mistake in 3rd edition, and Wizards of the Coast basically, I can guarantee, went back to challenge rating to just superficially make 5th edition look more like 3rd. Guarantee it. So things like that. But also, I wanted to highlight some of the things that were introduced in 4th edition that people have been kind of talking about as like, oh, well, I wonder if anybody homebrewed this in 3rd. And it's like, well, I don't necessarily know if people did or didn't homebrew it in 3rd. This was a codified mechanic in 4th, and that's where it came from. So I just wanted to talk a little bit. Here's some things that we can thank 4th edition for. Death saving throws. So prior to the death saving throw system, it was negative 10 hit points. Like like negative hit points. If damage reduced you to negative 10 hit points, you were dead. That was it. And if you, and like while you were at negative hit, while you were, if you were reduced to 0 hit points, or like, if you were at exactly 0, you were like, depending on some features or whatever, like it was, you were conscious, but couldn't take actions. Sometimes like you could take like an action, but not move or whatever, or you were unconscious, but stable. If you reached negative hit points, you then like automatically lost a hit point every turn. And healing did not bring you back to 0 first. So, 4th edition introduced the concept of death saves, where, I think 4th edition still had negative hit points. I think they increased it to like negative constitution or something like that. But, essentially, death saving throws as a new way to track like whether your character lived or died after being brought down to 0. I think it's a much more elegant system. I should note, for folks who think 5th edition is not punishing enough for death saves, so 5th edition, the way it works is if you are brought back, like if, so while you are making death saves, if you are brought back up to a hit point or if you are stabilized, the standard rules are your saves reset. In 4th edition, they don't. They don't reset until you finish a long rest. So if you're the kind of, group that, you know, doesn't really like the quote unquote whack-a-mole system in 5th edition of like people constantly getting dropped and then brought back up with like 1 point of healing, because of how healing in 5th edition works, you could institute that system of your successes and failures carry over, essentially your failures carry over, until you finish a long rest. So, you know, there's that. Another thing, at will cantrips. So technically speaking, third edition did have at will cantrips, sort of, in the form of the Warlock class, where Eldritch Blast was a class feature, and that allows you to just go like pew 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 pew. But it wasn't like a spell, because even zero level spells used spell slots in third edition. Fourth edition introduced the concept of at will powers, and basically sort of took the model that they were using for some later books in third edition, like Tome of Battle, and the Warlock, and using that as the model for sort of building out the classes, like all of the classes. And so casters now had options once they ran out of, you know, their other spells, to be able to just, like, you know, you didn't have to rely on carrying a crossbow or trying to mix it up and you having to get into a knife or running and cowering and hiding, because you've ran out of all your spells. So it allowed casters to still remain relevant, in a fight if they used all of their other spells. And that was a way to say, like, it's okay to use your spells and that the party can still keep going. It was introduced as a way to solve the 5-minute workday, which had been a big problem in third edition where, oh, the wizard ran out of spells. We're done for the day. Like, we're not going any further. Which was a design issue. Skill challenges. I see this brought up so often as wanting more robust ways of handling essentially non-combat encounters. And this is how, folks. This is a way to, you could even do it to replace combat if you wanted. Skill challenges are essentially the party has to make a number of successful skill checks before a number of failures. And with the stipulation that failing a skill challenge does not prevent progress, it just imposes a cost. Whereas, like, you know, success, like, means that you're able to do it without imposing any further cost. So, like, for example, like, traversing through the wilderness is a big example of if you failed it, like, it drains resources. It just so happens that a lot of the design that went into fifth edition makes it more difficult to do that. But, like, you could impose exhaustion as a way to do that. So, like, yeah, the party gains 2 levels of exhaustion. Or even a level of exhaustion that, you know, requires a con save to get rid of, or something, you know. And essentially, like, you know, skill, the idea was also for skill challenges to have a number of different skills that were relevant, so that way every character could contribute somehow. And then there were also, like, the podcast Critical Hit, an interesting take on it where, sort of imposing like a little bit of a narrative rule of 2 characters, that were right next to each, like, so if once you used a skill, the person right behind you in the initiative order, could not also use that skill in the skill challenge. And in addition, you could not use the same skill twice, from round to round, as a way to encourage people to really diversify, like, how they were, like, and to be creative, because skill challenges are meant to be narrative, and they're meant to take place, like, to simulate a thing that's happening over the course of time. And it was one of the things that, like, kind of got talked about positively when Forth was in its full swing, but has really gotten talked about a lot more now that it's out of fashion, or rather now that it's out of print, as like, hey, this was actually really good design. Gee, maybe everyone should have said that when it was in print. Rituals. So Rituals in Fourth worked a little differently than Rituals do in Fifth. So Rituals in Fifth, I'm kind of torn on them. So the way it works is like, if you have ritual casting, there's like a ritual casting feature and then a ritual caster feat, and they work differently. So the ritual caster feat, is like, you get a book and you can put spells in that book as long as they have like the ritual tag, and you can cast them as rituals. The ritual casting feature is like, if you either know spells or have spells prepared that have the ritual tag, you can cast them as a ritual. The way it worked in Fourth was, rituals were entirely separate from the rest of the spells. And traditionally utility stuff, like utility spells that appeared in other editions, showed up as rituals. And the idea being, you just needed the ritual caster feat, and you got a ritual book. Rituals would come in the book. You could go out and, you know, it, like, you could either find rituals to inscribe in the book, whether like there was a merchant that sold them, or you would get them as treasure, to then be able to cast like any number of times later. And then, you know, for classes that would have the ritual casting features, you just got the feat for free. I think that's one of the things that Fifth could have done if they had just decided, like, if they had just realized, listen, everybody's going to use feats. Like, I have never heard of a group that plays Fifth Edition that looked at that whole feat chapter and said, yeah, no, we're not going to do that. Like, they say it's optional, but, like, it's an option that everyone uses. So, like, you could have said, hey, you know, instead of making this weird, different subset of ritual casting, hey, let's just give them this feat for free. And then the way it worked is, rituals, they took a lot longer to cast. They required resources to cast. So they required ritual components, which were tied to the appropriate skill. So this was another thing, cool thing. Rituals were tied to skills. They weren't just like, oh, it's magic, so I just base it off of my spellcasting ability modifier, and then it just does a thing and it works and it's great, and I don't have to worry about, you know, like, why would I worry about athletics when I can cast spider climb and jump? Or fly. Whereas, or, you know, why would I need nature? Or, well, my favorite one is, why do I need animal handling when I could cast speak with animals, animal friendship, you know, dominate animal, like, all the various animal stuff, like, why would I need, oh, geez. I don't remember what the skill's called. Animal handling, right. In Fourth. So Fourth didn't have animal handling. It was all rolled into nature. But all of those ritual, all of those spells, essentially, were done as rituals, which keyed off of your nature skill. So, like, it was a way to do magic that was based on skills, which I thought was really neat. And that, like, it allowed you to do some really interesting magic that, like, could be more martial and, like, more non-magical by keying it off of skills that weren't traditionally associated with magic. So that was it. But overall, the system for rituals that we have is sort of based on fourth edition. Everybody's favorite cleric spell, Healing Word. Healing Word was a class feature for every support class in fourth. And that was essentially a way, that was the way for them to heal people. It was word. So clerics got Healing Word, but like bards got Inspiring Word. I think it was Inspire Word. Or might have been Majestic Word. And I think warlords got Inspiring Word. But basically, every support class got like a various word that was the equivalent of a bonus action. Also did a couple different rider effects. Limited uses per encounter. That was sort of your go-to maintenance healing. Whereas, you know, clerics also got stuff, you know, like Cure Wounds, which was a much more powerful healing spell, but allowed you to like be able to heal because it was just built into your class. And then you could, you know, you could go be a storm cleric and you would still have the ability to do that. So those are all things that you can thank. Dragonborn as they currently exist. So in third edition, Dragonborn was a thing where it was like you were a humanoid that like you underwent a ritual and then you were reborn as just like a metallic skinned version of yourself, pledged to Bahamut. Dragonborn as dragon person showed up in fourth. Also putting tieflings in the PHB, you can thank fourth edition for that, all you tiefling players. That was a big deal, let me tell you. When fourth came out, was like, tieflings in the player's handbook? Also the Astral Sea, since that's the way that we're moving toward Spelljammer, is that stats directly taken from fourth edition. Or, you know, if you're a fan of Critical Role and you like the Astral Sea and the Elemental Chaos, that's 4E cosmology right there. So those are just a few things that we can thank fourth edition for. Now, here's some things that fourth edition, I think, did right that they should have carried over, and things that they did well. So like, if you're a person that, you know, kind of wishes things worked a little differently in fifth edition, instead of trying to rewrite something on your own, see if you can find a copy of one of these books, take a look at it, and see if the systems in there are what you're looking for. Also goes without saying, like, check the 5th edition DMG first, just to make sure. There's so many people who are trying to rewrite things that like are just blatantly spelled out in the 5th edition Dungeon Master's Guide that end up solving the problem that they have. That disclaimer aside, first off, bloodied as a condition. I miss this as a condition. So bloodied is when a creature is reduced to 50% or fewer hit points. There's that threshold. When it's below that threshold, it's bloodied. There were a lot of monsters in fourth edition that had effects that keyed off of whether they were bloodied or whether targeting bloodied creatures, removing that kind of removed a neat aspect of design for the game. And so now you have things like the Blood Frenzy for Sharks and Sawagin, where it's like, if a creature is missing hit points or whatever, and it's like, you could have just said bloodied and like left it at that sort of a thing. Actually, that's going to tie into another thing, keywords, right? Fourth edition loved keywords. And I kind of do too. It allowed you to use a shorthand, way of saying things that like it ended up becoming so verbose in fifth edition. like Rogue Sneak Attack went from being like two lines of text and then, you know, your damage stuff, how like damage progresses in fourth edition, to like a full on two paragraphs of explaining how you get sneak attack in fifth. Just by virtue of the use of like combat advantage as a keyword. But also like, so all of your various abilities would have different keywords, and that allowed you to more easily write stuff out. So, you know, instead of saying like, whenever you cast a spell that deals fire damage, you know, it deals plus two damage. Whereas saying like all your, and you would put it in bold, like fire spells deal plus two damage. It's a very minor thing, but for me personally, it helps clean and tighten up your language. And it just means like, for me, it feels like a bit of a waste of space to just like add extra language to say the same thing. Granted, that's one of the things that turned people off of fourth edition, and I will maintain that it's largely because fourth edition wasn't written in a very, I don't know, like paragraphs weren't written out, and it was just like written very much like a technical, you know, game manual for like mechanics and stuff. And like putting things in like a specific format, which, you know, the trade dress hurt the game for sure. But that's neither here nor there. But yeah, so keywords, weapon groups. Weapon group is kind of related to this. Instead of it being like you getting proficiencies to specific weapons or broad categories of simple versus martial, weapons were broken down into types, essentially. And it was like basically seven or eight groups. Let's see if I can remember off the top of my head. So you had axes, you had bows, you had crossbows, you had heavy blades and light blades, you had hammers, maces, flails, pole arms, staffs. Okay, so that, I mean, that's 10. All right, so we're, you know, there's quite a few. I think whip was its own category. Oh, picks. Yeah, picks were back in the game. But and so for example, like longsword and greatsword were just classified as heavy blades. And then what you could do is with feats is it would be based on like if you're wielding a heavy blade, instead of having to get like if you're trying to design something like with swords in mind, like you have to kind of either say like when you're wielding a sword, and relying on people to kind of understand what you're talking about. You can just be very precise with your language. And then also, it allowed you to do really thematic stuff with various things. So, like, there was a feat where axes would deal extra damage against prone enemies, because you were doing like an executioner chop. You know, hammers allowed you to push people if you hit them. You know, and we see this with Polearm Master in fifth edition, where instead of having to sort of define what is a pole arm, you could just say pole arm. Because in the weapon table, like, it would assign a weapon group to every weapon, or multiple weapon groups. This technically allowed shenanigans where it was, oh geez, it wasn't Blade Singer, but there was a, geez, I can't remember the name of it. There was a arcane caster class that could only use heavy blades. And it was basically Blade Singer. But you could technically, like, work around it a little bit, because it was either glaives or halberds were classified as a heavy blade in addition to a pole arm. And so you could wield that while also being, like, this arcane caster. And so, like, it meant to be, like, that you were wielding a long sword and keeping one hand open and, like, dancing around and everything. And instead, you are just this brutal, like, eldritch knight swinging around a glaive. that made for some fun shenanigans. You know, kind of like that power sources. So, really defining, like, how different classes use their abilities. And so, and really kind of trying to delineate what is the difference between arcane magic, divine magic, primal magic, psionics, martial abilities, and essentially, by having that be a keyword, coming back to keywords, being able to assign traits to a group and have it apply to everything all at once. And that really allowed them to look at what, like, how do you want to make each of these unique? And so, yeah, I kind of missed that. I also missed, like, primal magic being a thing, like, because it helped give druids and rangers a bit more identity from, like, clerics, paladins, and, you know, rogues and stuff like that. And also allowed them to actually, like, define how psionics works, and probably did it the best way out of recent D&D editions. We also have action points. So, I see often pacing as another sort of complaint with 5th edition, and why, like, Wizards is suddenly no longer doing things based off of short rests. Action points were a thing in 4th, where when you finish a long rest, you get an action point. You had very, and action points basically allowed you to, you could spend it and you get an extra action. And that was, like, the point. But there were often ways on, like, you could spend an action point to do other things. Like, if you had a feat, if you had a class feature, if you had a magic item that allowed you to do that. So it was a way to, like, give you another resource that you could guarantee that you would get at least once a day. And the idea being that, like, if you did more encounters without resting, you would get action points, as a way to give you a resource, back and encourage you to keep going. And so, yeah, unfortunately, I don't know how you would add that back into 5th. Off the top of my head, I'm sure you could, but because, like, action points in 3rd were introduced in Eberron, and it was just, like, you could spend them to add a D6 to a die roll. But I really like I like the idea of it lets you do more stuff as a way to replace the fact that like you were gradually losing your abilities over the course of a day. And then to couple with that, that also applied to healing as well. So instead of hit dice, you got what are called healing surges. Now, healing surges, you got a set amount at first level. You never, you know, unless you took certain things, like it never naturally progressed past that point. And that was a measure of your class's ability to, your class's endurance. So typically, stuff that you might expect to be a bit more durable and you know, tougher, like physically tougher, got more healing surges. So obviously, wizards got very few. You know, barbarians and fighters and paladins got quite a bit. Healing surges were how most of the healing in the game was done. Healing was not free. Oftentimes, so with like Healing Word and other healing abilities, it required the target to spend a healing surge in order to regain the hit points, and then they would regain additional hit points, you know, based on whatever ability was used. If the target could not spend a healing surge, they couldn't be healed. And I think this might be a solution for people who are kind of trying to look for grittier stuff in 5e. You could do this by having it be based on hit dice, you know, and try and do more healing stuff based on hit dice. Cause the idea was, like a lot of your abilities were much more limited. Like, so, at first level, you know, right now, actually, let's not use first level as an example, because that's bad, because nobody gets a lot of stuff at first level. Let's say at third level, which in fourth edition terms would probably be around fifth. You know, you would get your at-will stuff. You'd get a couple of encounter-based powers, which so everybody got stuff that recharged after a short rest. And then everybody also got stuff that recharged after a long rest. You didn't have like spell slots. It was everybody worked off of the same structure. And so for a cleric, you could cast Cure Wounds once per day. And then like it was done. It was really powerful, but you could do it once. And like most of your healing was like this maintenance healing with Healing Word. But it was limited. It was limited both in the number of times you could do it per encounter, but also whether the person you're trying to heal had healing surges left. And like, it's funny in that, like, that's done as a limiting factor. When 4th edition characters were much more super heroic than 5th edition characters. So I think if you think 5th edition, like, healing is too ubiquitous, and that your character, like, and that your party is too durable, you know, maybe talk with your players and see if you want to like change stuff up. I think the easiest way is have Healing Word, change Healing Word to have it be that the target can spend hit dice. And see how that goes. So yeah, and then just, we're running over time. I know I wanted to keep this an hour so that I'm not like wearing myself out. Encounter design in 4E. So I mentioned CR, like challenge rating is a bad system. 4E has a much better system. Each monster had essentially a role, which was like a class, you know, basically, and to inform you how the monster should act in combat. So it might be like artillery, skirmisher, a big old tank. It would have a level, and then it would have a status, I guess, or threat level, you might say. So there were standard monsters, there were elites, there were solos, and there were minions. And you could very easily build an encounter by saying, I have four fourth level PCs. That amounts to four fourth level standard monsters. Elites were worth two monsters. Solos were worth five. Minions were 4-1. And then minions like had special rules where they had like one hit point. They dealt fixed amounts of damage, and they didn't take if stuff would deal half damage to them on a save, like they would take no damage, sort of a thing. So like it was a way to like just throw in chunks of stuff that like would still be threatening, but that would also, you know, give you reasons to like use Fireball. This is a much better system than challenge rating, which requires a table. Like, there's no rule of thumb. And even then, that table only works for one monster. Once you start adding more monsters, it screws everything up. And so, one personal project of mine is to try and go back and like try and figure out how to redo fifth edition monsters using 4E like monster design and encounter design. It's a tall order. The other thing, of course, is that 4E monsters, like, you didn't have to look outside of the monster stat block to figure out what the monster did. And it would include a lore box. So, like, if you wanted to roll a check to see, like, oh, what do I know about this monster, that provided that information in the monster description, in the monster manual, for various levels of knowledge, or various different types of skills. So, there we go. All right, I ran totally long. We're going to do quest log really quick, and then that'll close out this episode. So, time for quest log. All right, so technically, for last episode, said I was going to color a Chapter 1 comic and complete Click Clock Wood. I finished Banjo-Kazooie, and I did get a comic done. Got that done. This week, the plan is I'm going to finish Chapter 1, folks. That's two comics to color. So close to the end. The other big project I'm doing is I'm cataloging my Magic cards, my collection. Just, you know, in case we find a new house, and we have to pack stuff up and move it, just so that way, like, try and consolidate stuff and make a spreadsheet so that I know what I have. It's also to help me in case I want to build commander decks. But the goal is to catalog two decks worth of cards. I have a bunch of commander decks. I figured I'd get all the decks cataloged first and all the loose cards cataloged first, then go through the boxes and catalog that stuff. So it's a fair bit, but it's relatively easy work. So there we go. All right. This is a little bit of a longer episode. Well, it's a little bit over an hour. I could talk for hours about fourth edition, folks. I love it so much. Definitely had its problems. And there were definitely some design issues there, which led to, you know, stuff getting grindy and book bloat and things like that. But there's a lot of really good stuff that you can take from fourth, apply it to fifth, and chances are solve like anywhere from 50 to 90% of the problems that people have with fifth edition. That still want to play D&D. I will say that. You know, sometimes it's you really do just have to try a different game. So that is going to wrap up this episode for this week. Thank you all for joining me. Thank you. It's good to be back after so long. If you want to check out more of my content, you can go to 8-bitadventures.com. Over there, you can find the 8-Bit Adventures comic. You can find podcast VODs. My artwork. All that good stuff. If you would like to help support that content, in all the stuff as a whole, the best place to do that is become a patron over at patreon.com/8bitadventures. You can become a patron for as little as $1 a month. And it's charged monthly. So what you get is you get early access to comics. There's a whole bunch. There's about 50 patron exclusive comics up there. There's behind the scenes, sort of D&D playtest stuff, that I'm doing, and all that. Big shout out and thank you to all my current patrons. Thank you so much for your continued support. It's been a big help, just being able to, you know, pay for things, on the back end, And thank you again. Our opening theme is One Up by Professor Shy Guy. Please check out his work over at ProfessorShyGuy.bandcamp.com. He's great. So always, you know, One Up has been the theme for 263 episodes now. So for like 6 years. So I think at some point, you know, maybe going over and checking his work out, would be good. I would also highly recommend NPC. And there's also the RPG song, are all great too. And those are original works. He also does like covers of things. So that is going to wrap it up for this week. Again, thank you all so much for joining me. And as always, have fun, happy gaming, and enjoy your pie cake.